This episode of The Dig is brought to you by our listeners who support us at patreon.com and by Haymarket Books, which has loads of great left-wing titles, perfect for Dig listeners like you. One that you might like is Abolition, Politics, Practices, Promises, Volume 1 by Angela Y. Davis. For over 50 years, Angela Davis has been at the forefront of the fight against state violence and oppression. This book, the first of two important new volumes, brings together an essential collection of Davis's essays over the years, showing how her thinking has sharpened and evolved even as she has remained uncompromising in her commitment to collective liberation. Rich and rewarding, Abolition addresses the history of abolitionist practice and thought, the unique contributions of women to abolitionist struggles, and more. Find Abolition at haymarketbooks.org, where readers in the U.S. and U.K. receive free shipping on orders over $25 and £20, respectively. Welcome to The Dig, a podcast from Jacobin Magazine. My name is Daniel Denver, and I'm broadcasting from Providence, Rhode Island. This is the fourth episode of Thawara, The Dig's new series on 20th century Arab politics with historian Abdel Razak Takriti. Thawara is Arabic for revolution. It's a word that contains historical multitudes. Diverse political radicalisms and revolts that have swept across Arab lands over the past century. Today's installment lays out the politics surrounding the Zionist settler colonial destruction of Palestine, the Nakba of 1948, and a seismic event that followed in its wake, the 1952 Egyptian Free Officers Movement coup, led by Gamal Abdel Nasser, that would set the tone for two decades of revolutionary nationalism across the region. We also discuss why the Soviet camp supported the colonial partition of Palestine, and the calamitous impact of Moscow's decision upon powerful communist parties across the region. That all took place alongside massive and consequential arms sales from communist Czechoslovakia to Zionist forces. This is the first episode that we've done that gets into the historical sequence that is the true substance of this series. The political radicalisms that defined the Arab world throughout the 1950s and 60s. Nationalism, Nasserism, Baathism, Communism, and Islamism. The first three episodes we did, the ones that preceded today's discussion, they extensively outlined the historical context and background of the dawn and expansion of European imperialism across the Mashriq, the birth of Arab nationalism, and the post-colonial Arab state system through which these movements would struggle for power. This episode pushes our inquiry into the second half of the 20th century. Then, as now, Palestine is the nerve center through which so much of regional and global politics runs. Over the next couple episodes, we'll pick up with Nasser emerging victorious from the 1956 Suez Crisis, discuss the founding of the movement of Arab nationalists, and take a close look at 1950s Syria. I will readily concede that The Dig does not have the largest podcast listenership on earth, but we do have amongst the coolest, most revolutionary, and most zealously dedicated listeners. Many tens of thousands of you, people who are organizers and intellectuals doing really remarkable work all over the world. You do me the great honor of spending hours with me each week learning from my guests. One thing I want to ask you to do, since you are clearly paying such close attention, is to let people know, either in real life or on social media, that they should really check out Thawara. People are hungry for the history that we're laying out in this series right now. This is the critical context required by an increasingly third-worldist left inspired by Palestinian struggle. Listener dedication is also quite apparent because so many of you voluntarily contribute at patreon.com/thedig to make this podcast possible so that we can fundraise what we need without paywalling any episodes. If you depend on The Dig, if you can afford to contribute, if you want to support The Dig, please pause and contribute what you can at patreon.com/thedig. There is a link in the show notes. Depending on where you live and how much you contribute, we have tote bags, mugs, books to send you in the mail, and all contributors get our excellent newsletter written by Ben Mabee, delivered by email to your inbox. That's patreon.com/thedig. Thank you. And here's Abdelrazak Takriti, who teaches history at Rice University. A scholar of Arab and Palestinian revolutionary movements, he's the author of Monsoon Revolution, Republicans, Sultans, and Empires in Oman, and the co-author of The Palestinian Revolution Digital Humanities Website, an incredible resource that will be back online soon. In 1952, a group of revolutionary Egyptian military officers led by Gamal Abdel Nasser, known as the Free Officers Movement, launched a nationalist coup that overthrew King Farouk. There's a lot to talk about here, but before we get to that, let's go back over some of the history that leads up to that moment in Egypt. How did Britain's imposition of its imperial order and the nationalist resistance that emerged to fight it, how did that all lay the groundwork for the Free Officers' coup?
Daniel, if we want to discuss the background to the Free Officers and Nasserism, we have to understand that the British occupation of Egypt created multiple crises in the country. One was a crisis of politics. This was a country that had some constitutional experiments before the British arrival. In fact, the British arrival came as a response to the anti-colonial Urabi movement, which had demanded a restored parliament from Khedewi Tawfiq in December 1881. And after a lot of drama around that demand, the British came in and cracked down on the attempt to create a more democratic space in Egypt, and definitely a space that also allowed greater popular role and a greater Egyptian role in government. So we had a crisis of politics. It was a crisis of democracy. And the British were definitely opposed to democracy. We know this from their own documents. Lord Dufferin's report of 1883, upon which the British imperial policy rested, made it clear that a truly democratic government in Egypt was a threat to British interests and was unsuited to what he called an quote-unquote Oriental country. So they had this racist vision. That led for several decades of fighting and struggle on the part of Egyptians to create more representative institutions. Struggles of that sort for constitutional representation and for elections and parliaments, of course, can lead to cross-class alliances. So when it came to the democratic question, you could have people belonging to the upper classes, including some of the landowners even, to demand representative government and elections and so on, because they want a cut of the rule. And they want a piece of the pie. Under colonialism, they're completely excluded. But obviously, people want to be represented, including the upper classes under colonialism. Now, this then forms a backdrop to the sort of coalition that was really a national coalition that led to the 1919 revolution.
This is the WAFT.
This is the WAFT was the main or the largest party that emerged out of that process victorious. So if you want to know about the background, there's a good summary given by the prominent Egyptian historian Mohammed Shafiq Gharbal. He said, the occupation did not terminate the hope for independence. It did not please all the classes and sects at the same time, nor did it anger all of them at the same time. Whenever it pleased or angered, it did so with calculated measure. Its main concern was to feed the desperation of certain groups in relation to others. The people feared the return of absolute rule and its sins. The throne feared the return of the Arabists. The reactionaries feared the spread of the call for renewal. The modernizers feared the release of reaction upon them. And the government reformers and the possessors of real interests feared that politics and its men would become dominant, taking away people from useful work and so on. So this is a good summary of the different class interests that had prevailed during the period of occupation before the 1919 revolution. Now, the Great War produced a transformation in Egyptian politics, and it meant that the undemocratic situation that was enforced upon the country by the British occupation was unsustainable. You had an economic situation also that was unsustainable. We saw greater expansion in the power of landed classes under British occupation. There was an entire restructuring of social relations, increasing entry of Europeans into the country. They were owning more and more in that country. And as a result, you also had a crisis of land. And land reform became a big theme that all Egyptians from the non-landed classes would talk about. This is a primarily agrarian country with a very large peasant population, but most of them are denied access to any substantial or real form of land ownership. So we have a political question and we have an economic question. The political question, you can have national coalitions form around it. The economic question, that's where class struggle takes place. And they're both occurring at the same time. This is why it's difficult to talk about stories like this. In a way, the free officers represented the distillation of both questions into a single form. And they represented the contradictions that were inherent in these questions. They were trying to pursue both at the same time. Now, the Wafd had actually, contrary to the claims of free officers later on, the Wafd was discussing the land question as well as demanding independence and more representative government. So what it got out of the 1919 revolution is a form of independence that was not genuine, but that did allow for certain symbolic institutions to emerge, greater participation in politics. But of course, when it came to real sovereignty issues, the British still retained power.
And so who were the free officers led by Nasser as people, as a concrete group of people? And then more broadly, what was the class composition of the junior officer class? And how did that shape what became their just critically protagonist role at this moment in Egyptian politics?
Yeah, I mean, one thing we should think about is that all of them were shaped by the story of the 1919 revolution and its aftermath. These were people that came of age in the interwar period. They were young men who had benefited from access to the military academy and the opportunities that came as a result of the expansion of the British, of the Egyptian army and the opening of its ranks to young men from social backgrounds like those of the free officers. A good example is Nasser himself. He was the son of a postal worker. So he also, his origins could be traced to the countryside, not to the fancier families. But within the countryside, he belonged to a family that would count as respected family in its own area. They were of the middling sort in Egyptian society. So the background is very important. It's what future Arab analysts would refer to as a petty bourgeois background. But I'm not sure, again, like I always use these terms with a bit of caution.
Because they can be a bit anachronistic.
They can be. So Nasser was actually somebody who benefited from education. There are people that tell you, oh, these were ignorant officers, army officers, uncultured and so on. Actually, if you do a bit of research, as I did, into Nasser's background, you'll find that, you know, he was exposed to different bodies of knowledge throughout his schooling. He, for example, encountered the main figures and personages of the Nahda, which we spoke about earlier, the late 19th century and early 20th century Arab intellectual renaissance. We know that he read Kawakib al-Istibdad, The Nature of Despotism, and these other texts, Umm al-Qura, these were anti-monarchical or at least pro-representative texts. They're anti-despotic texts. Anti-monarchical may be too much of an exaggeration in relation to them, but they definitely critique unchecked monarchical rule. And they call for the rejuvenation of Arab and Islamic lands through battling tyranny. And they also emphasized notions of civic virtue. These kind of ideas he was definitely exposed to. He was also at school. He went to Al-Nahda Secondary School, which is named after this Renaissance, the Renaissance Secondary School. And, you know, he was exposed to things like Julius Caesar. He actually acted in a play that was performed in that school based on Shakespeare's play, Julius Caesar. And, of course, that's a play which was less of a celebration of a great man and more of a profound political reflection on the nature of the republic. So there was a republican ideas were playing a role in this intellectual formation of Nasser. In all likelihood, Nasser would have also encountered a couple of 19th century novels that dealt with questions of monarchical rule. You know, his secondary school curriculum featured Hafez Ibrahim's translation of Les Misérables, as well as an Arabic edition of Charles Dickens' Tale of Two Cities. There's also clear evidence that one of his teachers, Ahmed Hassanein al-Qurani, recommended to him biographies of distinguished Republican personages. And based on that, Nasser wrote a short piece for his school magazine under the title Voltaire, Man of Liberty. So here the intellectual formation is very important. These were people that were exposed to certain ideas. Nasser later on in the military academy was reading a lot of grand strategy books as well. So there's all these books about the main international personages of the period, the big imperial interests and battles. He was fascinated clearly with how empires strategize and how they conduct grand strategy. So all of this, I think, is worth mentioning here. When it comes to the intellectual formation of these folks. There were people that also participated in political movements and experiments. You know, there's clear evidence that he had joined Misr al-Fatah, Young Egypt, that he was critical, you know, that he explored different political parties and currents. There was some free officers were actually in the Muslim Brotherhood or flirted with it. Some of them had encounters with the Communist Party. Certainly, Nasser was not ignorant about the presence of that party or its activities. You had a range of ideas floating around. But one thing that became clear was that almost all of them were beginning to feel that the political system was in crisis and that it was unable to deal with the main problems of the country. It was unable to address the problem of independence, the problem of land reform, the problem of Egyptian sovereignty, and the problem of economic modernization, as far as they saw it. Many of these problems had already been discussed already in the Wafdist press. There was actually a left wing of the Wafd as well that did try to deal with these problems. It talked about all sorts of issues ranging from, you know, the crisis of cotton to the role of women to different social reform agendas and economic reform agendas. And some of these would have clearly benefited the working classes and the peasantry. But the Nasserists, however, were keen to emphasize that the Wafd had failed miserably at translating these discussions into action.
All these problems that you laid out, they become fundamentally understood as problems rooted in imperialism and colonialism, something made very clear in 1948 to not only Nasser, but to all Arab political actors throughout the region. And we're going to get into the impact of the Nakba on Nasser and the entirety of Arab politics in some more depth in a minute. But first, just lay out the basics of 1952. How did the revolution happen? What sort of revolution was it? And how did Nasser emerge as its paramount leader?
A key moment in the trajectory of the free officers was the 1948 war, a few years before the revolution, but it causes a situation of crisis. War for Palestine becomes a major, major background story to the Egyptian revolution, because the Egyptian government ends up participating in the war, even though it was hesitant to do so. There was enormous popular pressure for that participation. There was a feeling that Palestine was going to be lost if the Arab governments did not intervene, that a settler colonial government would be set up there if they did not intervene, and that the people will be expelled from there if they did not intervene. Because already, as we mentioned in previous episodes, by in 1947, as soon as the partition resolution gets adopted by the United Nations, of course, a colonial United Nations at the time, we have a situation where the colonists in Palestine start ethnically cleansing the Palestinian population. And people in Egypt are beginning to see that, including Nasser and several of the free officers. And they actually initially volunteer to fight in that war. And even before the Egyptian army deployed in a more formal and coordinated and larger basis. So these were people that were keen to fight colonialism early on. And they viewed colonialism in Egypt as connected to a broader colonial phenomena elsewhere across the region. So, and that's important to understand later on for Nasser's anti-colonial agenda. Some people say and emphasize that he did not have a vision of what he wanted to do before the revolution. I actually disagree. He did have a general vision. Some of the specifics then the event shaped him. But you know, we could debate this endlessly. The problem with figures like Nasser is because they ended up with a very mixed legacy, and because he's a founder of the new Egyptian Republic with all the problems that we see now, it's easy to either utterly dismiss them or utterly glorify them. So we end up with either very disparaging accounts or hagiographic accounts. So we need to avoid both. So Daniel, when we speak of the revolution itself, the word revolution might be misleading. In fact, many people refer to the initial event that took place as a coup, which is true. If you look at it as a in terms of just pure mechanics, it was a coup. This was not like 1919, where there was a great social revolution going on. The entirety of Egyptian society mobilized, went out in huge demonstrations in the street, carried out wide range of popular actions and mobilizations. So the level of social mobilization here was not only low, it was almost non-existent in this event.
People were going about their daily lives full of all the contradictions of colonial / post-colonial Egypt while the coup was launched by military officers.
Correct. Now, nevertheless, historians do refer to an Egyptian revolution, and when they do so, they're actually talking about the long process of social, political, and economic transformation that this coup had produced. Because you had actually a government that came in power as a result of this coup that carried out a range of policies that were quite revolutionary by the standards of what had preceded them. And the debate is not whether there was actually profound change after 1952. It was to what extent was that change radical or not? So it's a question of extent, not a question of quality here. There was definitely a qualitative shift taking place in Egypt after 52 on multiple fronts, and we can outline them in a second. But before we do so, we should note that basically out of the political and economic crisis that had occurred in Egypt, there was an organization within the army that developed. It called itself the Free Officers. These were officers that had fought in the 1948 war, that had developed relationships with each other, that had benefited from greater access of the Egyptian lower middle classes into the military, and that were determined to find solutions for the big questions that Egypt was confronting. The one thing that united them was a feeling that the current status quo, including all the major political parties in it, had failed and were unable to deliver independence or development in Egypt. So they carried out the coup in 52. And basically, when they did that, they had to then find a leader to assign that would be recognizable to the general public. So essentially, they had formed a committee that was running the show after the coup, a revolutionary committee, but they needed a figurehead. So they chose the first Egyptian president, President Naguib, as that figurehead, because he was an army general who was more sympathetic to the demands of the youth within the army, to which these young officers, you know, that was a category that these young officers belonged to, but who was essentially not as radical as they were. You know, this is somebody who did not actually launch the coup, was not behind the overthrow of the government, but had been installed as a figurehead. The real power was a talented young officer who is clearly the strongest amongst this group, which was Gamal Abdel Nasser. So we had the situation in the initial years where Gamal Abdel Nasser was really the central figure, but he couldn't present himself as such fully because he still had to, he was operating as part of a group of free officers, and he had to also initially operate under a figurehead, which was President Naguib. So it's very clear that the free officers initially lacked a clear political program, certainly not one that corresponded with the ideological visions of any of the three main political currents that had become dominant in Egypt in the 1940s, liberalism, Islamism, and communism. And so this group of military men had a diverse set of political intellectual experiences and backgrounds, and it's important to emphasize that they by no means operated as a united ideological bloc. So Nasser in some ways had to always navigate through this contradiction. He was the head of a group that did not have a unified ideology, but that basically reflected different centers of power within the military. And this is quite significant for us to understand because at least until 1967, Nasser actually always had to account for the other officers surrounding him. You couldn't speak of just Nasserist rule. Nasserist rule was basically, there is a strong figure here in this coalition, but they answer to a bigger military group. It's not quite a junta in the traditional sense, because you have a strong figure within it that does have some ideological interests, but sometimes people compare it to that. And as a result of that, you had a bit of a politics of trial and error in the initial moments. But you do get the overthrow, you do get important decisions being made in the early period. First, there was a clear analysis of the Ancien regime that was put forth, especially in Nasser's speeches. In his second speech following the 52 revolution, he weaved an elaborate historical narrative that crossed the woof of opposition to colonialism with the warp of anti-monarchism. So you start hearing from Nasser these two themes. He's saying that Egypt was handed over, and he uses this term, by the Ottoman Caliph to English colonialism. And he's saying that that produced a system of slavery, he uses that word, that led to the country being choked, and I'm quoting him here, choked by two iron hands, social injustice and political tyranny. Now, this image becomes regularly occurring. And Nasser announces from the beginning that he's going to tackle the social injustice and he's going to tackle the political tyranny.
You've laid out the social, political, colonial context of the free officers movement. You've laid out, in terms of class composition, who the free officers and Nasser are. What does the revolution actually look like?
So initially, there was a warning that was issued to King Farouk on July 26, 1952. This was 3 days after the officers carried out the coup. You know, they went, took over the organs of government, literally, like any other coup, occupied main buildings, you know, surrounded the palace, essentially took control over the main organs of power and neutralized any opposition to their movement within the army. This, of course, we're not going to go into the details of it. There was a lot of drama. There were elections in the officers' club before that. They were worried that they were going to be exposed. So that all influenced the timing. But they ended up doing a decisive move, took over the reins of power. They issued 3 days later the warning to a king. And in that warning, they declared themselves, the army declared itself, actually, as, quote, the representative of the power of the people. They essentially used popular sovereignty language to justify and legitimate themselves. And they demanded that King Farouk abdicate rule to his son, Ahmed Fuad. And they cited his, quote, abuse of and tampering with the constitution and contempt for the will of the people as the main legitimation vehicle for this demand. Now, soon thereafter, by June 18, 1953, they decide to actually abolish the monarchy altogether. In just under a year, they actually abolished the entire monarchical system. Initially, they started with an abdication demand, and then they actually just completely abolished the monarchy. At the same time, another political thing they were doing is initially, they tried to engage with the political parties, but we ended up then seeing them destroying these parties, which were presented by the officers as divisive and as being vehicles of colonialism or vehicles of alignment in the emerging Cold War. This was a clear dynamic. Initially, some parties were supportive of the revolution, including the Muslim Brotherhood. Initially, was supportive, and there were some members of the revolution that were even seen. Some members of the free officers that were even seen as very close to the brothers, including some people even suspected that Nasser himself was. However, in reality, that was not to last long. The honeymoon did not last long with the brothers. So there was, you know, a total collapse in that relationship. The Weft was the sworn enemy of the free officers in many ways. They really were working hard on dismantling it. That was the strongest established mainstream party, and they really cracked down on that. So we see here a suppression of party life that was to continue for many years, and at the same time, removal of the monarchy.
Arab armies lost to Zionist forces in 1948. Palestinians' Nakba was a catalyzing and absolutely shocking moment for Arabs everywhere, very much including, as we've already referenced a few times, very much including for Nasser and other Arab officers who'd fought in Palestine. How did that defeat and the Nakba shape the politics of military officers like Nasser? And more broadly, stepping back beyond Egypt, how did it shape just the entirety of Arab politics? Because it's obvious why the Nakba was a catastrophe for Palestinians expelled from their lands. In what ways was it also experienced as a catastrophe by Arabs everywhere?
There's a terminology in Arabic that refers sometimes to something called Duwal al-Tuq, the countries surrounding Palestine. And these are primarily the countries bordering it, of course. These countries have a strong historic relationship with Palestine and different parts of it for geographic, social, and economic and cultural reasons. And of course, before the division of the Arab Ottoman lands took place, Palestine was part of the same political formation to which all of these lands had belonged, which was the Ottoman Empire, and before it, various Muslim empires. Palestine and Egypt, in particular, have a long history. I mean, they were often ruled under the same empires, more often than not, by the way, including in ancient times. For, again, geographic reasons, Egypt has especially close relationships with the Gaza region, which is, of course, the gateway between Africa and Asia, and it is right on the center of the map. If you hear the accent of the people of Gaza, they speak with some Egyptian influences. It's the closest part of Palestine to Egypt. So we have these amazing entanglements. But beyond that, and that produces then a popular mood that is supportive when it comes to a question of colonization like this. There is this cultural affinity, there's these social relations, there's all of these dynamics that are important. There's also a clear understanding of the cause, because people in this region understood what colonialism is. Yeah. And Egypt understood what colonialism was early on, because actually it had been severed from the Ottoman sphere quite early on. So yes, Muhammad Ali was governing it independently when he became governor, but in reality was still formally part of the empire. We end up with the British, once they take control, they're really separating it from the overall dynamics, politically, socially, and economically. And that meant that there was a national struggle in Egypt earlier than other parts of the region, which is why a lot of the anti-colonial ideas in the Arab world developed there, and they were borrowed from Egypt in areas that were colonized later. So all of these factors matter. There are intimate connections. There's an understanding of what colonialism is. And there's also an understanding that settler colonialism is the worst form possible. Because that doesn't just mean that you're temporarily under the rule of an empire. It means permanent loss of the land. It's an existential question. There had been a lot of Palestinian figures also that were operating in Egypt, and Egyptian figures, in solidarity with Palestine from the days of the Balfour Declaration, but more intensely during the 36 revolt in Palestine. There had developed a strong solidarity scene in Egypt that was also educating the general public about what was going on. And certain movements in Egypt opposed the settler colony on different grounds. The communists initially, until later on the Soviet Union forced them to water down their positions, but much of the communist movement was opposed to Zionism initially. And of course, Egyptian communists continued to be opposed to Zionism throughout, even if sometimes under pressure from the Comintern, they were forced to accept partition resolution and so on. The Islamists were definitely opposed to the idea of a settler colony being set up in Palestine. And they sent volunteers to fight in the 48 war, which of course added to their prestige in Palestine, as well as in Egypt. Different political currents and parties had clear agendas on this. And that meant that when the moment of 48 came, there was an effervescence of activity demanding that Egypt intervene. The three officers were no exception. They were really upset at the images of refugees being expelled from Palestine. They were really upset about the actual tragedy that was unfolding on the ground. Unlike people in the U.S. who had no understanding of this process, most of them still don't. And maybe now the new generation here is seeing the images of Gaza, and they're beginning to sympathize because of social media. But in 1948, there was no understanding of what the experience of the Palestinian people was in this country. Most people thought that what was happening was a great event. So this experience meant that 48 war had a transformative impact. The Egyptian officers that fought in it felt that they were not given adequate weapons, that they were not given adequate instructions, that the war plan was deficient, that there were contradictory interests at play there amongst the different Arab governments that had sent troops to fight. The Arab government of Jordan, for example, was clearly mainly focused on gaining and protecting the West Bank, because that's the bit that it wanted to annex. And they did put strong resources in defending East Jerusalem. But they were not, you know, fighting enough on other fronts as far as the Egyptians were concerned. And sometimes they felt that Egyptians felt that their war effort was being undermined by that government. At the same time, the Egyptian officers felt that their supply lines were not good. You know, the Egyptian army had reached as far as Hebron in the 48th war, and they should have been able at least to go as far as Yaffa from Gaza had there been, at least in the minds of the three officers, had there been adequate supply lines, had there been adequate weaponry provided. Many of them felt that the truce that took place between the Arab armies and the Zionists was also to the favor of the Zionists, that they were doing well before that, but then the Zionists were able to rearm, benefit from breaking actually the international embargo and sending weapons there. They got the Czech arms deal. So they felt that their government was a failure on many levels. It failed technically, it was outmaneuvered. And they attributed all of these failures in 1948 to the problems of the regime at home. And Nasser said this actually in his own reflection on the 1952 revolution. He wrote a book called The Philosophy of Revolution. He says, we were fighting in Palestine, but our minds were in Egypt.
It's interesting because it seems like that post-Nakba Arab political actors and thinkers, Nasser very much included, that they were trying to simultaneously examine the success of Western imperialism and Zionism on the one hand, but also Arab states' weakness and failure on the other. That this was not just about blaming the Zionist and Western enemy, but also beyond that, a call for profound self-examination and then the reconstruction of Arab governments, Arab elites, and Arab society. Did the Nakba provoke a sort of legitimacy crisis for the Arab status quo everywhere?
It did. Look, we know from history in general that military defeats do produce legitimation crises, and that was definitely the case here. But this was worse than just a military defeat. This was the loss of a key part of the Arab region, a part of the Arab region that held immense symbolism, culturally, religiously. The immediate reference that people thought of was the Crusades, certainly from an Islamic perspective. they viewed this as some repetition of that. You had foreign forces come in from Europe, and again, they were coming in from Europe, taking over the space and essentially causing immense damage. Now, in this case, also people with the less Islamic references secularized that story. They viewed it as the ultimate in the new colonial onslaught. For people who study this period and after, there was a general hatred for settler colonialism. And not just when it came to Palestine, but also Algeria. Both Palestine and Algeria came to animate people much more than other struggles, not because people didn't care about other struggles, but because they understood the existential dimension at play here. So yes, there was a crisis of legitimation happening in relation to the loss of Palestine, partly because people felt that it could have been prevented had there been adequate government in place, and had there been a more representative government. Now, in Egypt, the three officers blamed that loss directly on the government. They actually talked about it. They used it to expose the government further. But they were also keen to emphasize that that this was a symptom of the bigger problem, which is the structure of rule in Egypt. Had there been good government in Egypt, they said and felt, then this would not have happened in the first place. Similar sentiments, maybe even more, ones that centered Palestine even more, were expressed in other political ideologies that later on came to coalesce with Nasserism. So the thinker that had influenced the movement of Arab nationalists the most, Constantine Zurich, for example, he wrote a book called Ma'na Nakba, The Meaning of Catastrophe. And he actually, by the way, he did not coin the term. It was the word Nakba had existed in Arabic for a long time. But he basically associated it with Palestine in a very specific way in his book, The Meaning of the Nakba, The Meaning of Catastrophe. And there he's saying, look, the only response that is possible to this is the unification of the Arab world, the Arab region, and And for him, he's viewing it in nationalist terms. So this means the unifying the nation that has been artificially divided as far as Konstantin Zurich is concerned. And essentially modernizing it. So all that would mean that you have to overthrow all the regimes in the region. You have to overthrow all the colonial powers that are behind it. Egyptian government was seen as a tool of the British. It was not seen as a fully independent government. It was tied with Britain with multiple treaties. Britain still controlled the Suez Canal, by the way, in this period. It still had troops in Egypt. That's something that people should not forget when we talk about 52 revolution. Part of the big demand was, well, the West and the other parties have failed to get the British out. And they're doing negotiation after negotiation, but they're not getting us anywhere. And we need to find a way where full Egyptian sovereignty is restored. So, you know, similar crises are happening elsewhere. In Jordan, that Jordan is still tied to Britain with a treaty. And by the way, that treaty gets canceled or abrogated later on as a result of popular pressure that was partly influenced by the Free Officers' Revolution in Egypt. Because the minute that free officers take power, they begin to also establish a program for popularizing their ideas in the Arab world. And we can talk about this in a bit. And that's done through radio at the time, Daniel. I'm sure as a radio person yourself and as a distinguished podcast host, you will appreciate the power of the airwaves.
I'm Naomi Klein, and you're listening to The Dig, my go-to podcast for the most thoughtful, in-depth conversation on the left. It's an incredible place to be exposed to new ideas and new writing. And if you can, please become a sustaining supporter at Patreon.
The Dig is a podcast produced in conjunction with Jacobin Magazine. And yes, Jacobin is a print publication, not just a place for online commentary, but long-form, serious print journalism and socialist analysis. The magazine is released quarterly and runs at around 160 pages, filled with award-winning design and the ideas that movements need to thrive. You can join more than 70,000 Jacobin subscribers supporting this vital work for just $15 for your first year. This is a huge discount available to Dig listeners. $15 gets you an entire year of Jacobin in print and access to the magazine's very extensive archive. Their latest issue is on aging. It describes the challenges facing welfare states, debates the value of generational analysis, and asks what kind of society our elders deserve. I highly recommend that you check it out. You can access this deal by going to bit.ly/digjacobin, all lowercase. That's bit.ly/digjacobin, all lowercase. There's a link in the show notes. In Jordan, you mentioned that the popular pressure forced the monarchy to break its treaty with Britain, because at the time, the Jordanian armed forces had a British commander. The person in charge was a British man.
Correct. So Daniel, if we look at the regional map, it's quite astonishing, like at this moment. Even though Egypt formally was independent and a member of the United Nations, and the British controlled its main resources, which is the Suez Canal. You had a situation where Jordan was tied to Britain with a military treaty and various other treaties. You had a situation where Iraq was tied to Britain with similar treaties.
And had British troops on the ground in Iraq as well.
Absolutely, and that was a long struggle that took place in Iraq between the popular movements and the British. And of course, again, because of the situation we described earlier in the podcast, where the British were often acting through local governments, sometimes in opposition to them, but in generally the structural situation was that these governments were tied to the British. So it complicated things. It meant that a lot of the popular anger against colonialism was also directed at these monarchical structures in the case of Egypt, Jordan, and Iraq. Additionally, you know, if you look at the regional map at this stage, the British had control over the entirety of the Gulf shore aside from Saudi Arabia.
Through their control of the Trucial States.
The Trucial States, but also Kuwait, Bahrain, what's now United Arab Emirates, all the seven Emirates there, plus Oman and Qatar. That's a lot. And we're not even talking here about the Aden colony and their immense intervention in everything relating to Yemen and the sultanates that they had created there. They had created a confederation, a sultanate, multiple sultanates under different rulers in Yemen that they had also under their umbrella. So they wielded enormous influence in this region, Daniel.
And this is the British power, the overwhelming British power across the region in the wake of the British just handing Palestine to Zionist settler colonists.
Absolutely, absolutely. And Britain was seen as responsible for the loss of Palestine. It had created a mandate. It had issued the Balfour Declaration, incorporated it into the mandate. Without it, Zionism would have been impossible. You know, there were various colonies established during the late Ottoman period, for example, but they had no hope of taking over the country. You needed an empire to come in and actually facilitate that. And no matter how much the British claim that they're balancing interests or whatever, but nobody in the region believes that. Because they just have to read the actual mandate terms itself, which actually say and specify that the mandates, one of the mandate's main purposes is to facilitate the establishment of a Jewish national homeland in Palestine. And later on, of course, Palestinians and Arabs understood that this means the creation of a Jewish state there at the expense of the actual indigenous population. So that is something that really continues to be a major issue to this very day. Nobody has forgiven Britain for that. And most Arab analysts will tell you that their anger is directed at the British, not only for committing that, what they see as a major crime, but also for refusing to even acknowledge it or apologize for it to this day.
We should touch on these early years of post-Nakba Palestinian politics before we circle back to Nasserism, because the Palestinian cause is central to all the movements and all the politics we'll be discussing throughout all these episodes, and not just because Palestine was symbolically important for Arabs across the region, symbolically and concretely, though it was very much so, but also because Palestinians in the diaspora across the region become influential in so many ways. The presence of Palestinian refugees quickly becomes very consequential in Lebanon, Jordan, the Arabian Gulf. Political theories of Arab liberation typically hinge on defeating Zionism for all of the reasons we were just discussing. And in our next episode, we'll talk in detail about the movement of Arab nationalists, which is a really remarkable organization with just kind of dozens of afterlives, consequential political afterlives, that was founded and led in significant part by Palestinians, but with a project initially that was really fundamentally pan-Arab rather than solely or narrowly about Palestinian national liberation. But we're going to get into all of that in the next episode. But for now, I want to just set up some basics. What did it even mean to have a Palestinian national politics after the Palestinian nation had been shattered in the way that it was in 1948 in these early years? And when it was so often Arab governments who were speaking on behalf of Palestine rather than Palestinians themselves, Arab governments that were so often restricting and repressing Palestinian refugees at the same time.
Yeah, I mean, you're really asking a very profound question here, Daniel. And for Palestinians, of course, this was the key question of the post-Nakba period. Palestine was already losing a lot of its ability to organize politically because the British were promoting Arab rulers in Palestine at the expense of the national movement in Palestine. So in particular, King Abdullah, who was previously Prince Abdullah, Amir Abdullah, he was increasingly intervening in local Palestinian politics from 36 onwards.
Against the Mufti, who had been exiled after 36.
Yes. And here the issue is not to, talk about whether the Mufti is better than Abdullah or anything like that. We have to stop thinking of it in terms of personages. This is a structural question. Will the national movement in Palestine be responsible for carrying out the fight there against colonialism? Or will the Arab governments be given control over the local space, which means in this case, governments that are connected to Britain and therefore are limited in their ability to confront it? They will never confront the British project. They can't. Okay. They receive their money from Britain. Their armies are led by British officers, like you mentioned. And that became a big question in Palestinian political life during this period. In general, most people viewed themselves as being betrayed by the Arab governments. You know, they were asking, where are the Arab governments? I mean, I'll give you an example, Daniel, from the Nakba. One of the biggest disasters was the fall of Jaffa. Jaffa fell a few days before the Arab armies entered into Palestine. And really, had they put some effort into supplying it and maintaining the defense of it until the British formal withdrawal, then that would have caused a major problem for the Zionists during the war. There's a reason why the Zionists focused on Jaffa. It's partly because it's one of the two major economic capitals of Palestine, Jaffa and Haifa, were the most dynamic cities, and because it was a cultural capital. But beyond that, it's right next to Tel Aviv, right next to the headquarters of the whole colonial operation. Or I should say Tel Aviv is right next to it, because Tel Aviv was a colony that was established on the outskirts of Jaffa and later on ate Jaffa. It's actually a relationship between the two cities, actually. It summarizes everything. An ancient place like Jaffa gets taken over by a place founded in 1909 by settler colonists. And that's basically the story of Palestine. So they did not supply it enough. They did not protect it. It fell. Okay. Imagine a world in which Jaffa had lasted a couple of weeks later. And I don't like counterfactuals, but sometimes we have to use them to think like the people on the ground were thinking.
And to understand the contingency that's at work in different ways and to different degrees at different moments, and understanding sort of what is contingent at particular moments in history and what is not, what moments are more closed and what moments are more open, is, I think, a key task for this sort of historical analysis.
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, you look at something like Jaffa, it fell because they were not willing to supply it enough and because they were not willing to back enough the actual military leader. There was an Iraqi officer that was, leading the effort there. They should have provided him with the necessary supplies to be able to continue the fight. It had actually fought hard, Jaffa, and the people in its countryside really were able to hold the ground strongly. Villages like Salama, Yazur, these were areas that there was immense resistance. And through popular mobilization, and people were needing arms. They were just saying, send us arms. Light weapons would have done. Mortars. Nothing was available for the people to fight with. That becomes important for Palestinians, by the way, later on. Because they're like, without a fighting capacity, you will lose everything. That was the view. Okay. That was one of the lessons they learned from the Nakba, which is why in this next phase after the Nakba, they emphasized the need for Palestinians to have independent military capacity. That becomes a theme that is especially important for Fatah, but later on it gets adopted by everybody. And of course, we see it playing out even today. That's one of the main differences between today the governing authority in Ramallah, Palestinian Authority, and of course the leadership of Fatah, ironically, and Hamas. So in structural terms, that's a big question. Now, here in this country's view through the prism of security and terrorism and so on, you know, in colonial terms, in places like Palestine, where people are colonized, they think of it in terms of, well, who's going to defend us when our cities are being attacked? That's a big question. Jaffa is being attacked without weapons. What are they going to do? The Arab governments did not give enough weapons. So the city fell. And, you know, had it not fallen, the Egyptians would have conceivably been able to have a direct supply line from Gaza all the way to Jaffa, all the way to Tel Aviv. That would have changed the course of the war. This is not to mention the demoralization. When a major place like Jaffa falls, that means you have entire villages that will be demoralized. entire cities that will be demoralized. It causes immense fear. And, you know, the story was replicated over and over and over again. And it was covered in the Arab countries, and people were exposed to it. So they felt the pain. The Arab public felt the pain. They saw the refugees coming from this. And they saw the bad treatment that the refugees were given by some governments. Not all of them, but some of them, you know, like including the Egyptian government, by the way. So, and that was against the popular mood, by the way. The Arab people were immensely sympathetic to a Palestine refugee. So as a result of the Nakba, you have, first of all, the destruction of all the major political parties that had existed in Palestine before. The only party that actually survives and in very reconstituted forms is the Communist Party. Okay, and they end up actually splitting into multiple parties. There are the communists that reunited with the Jewish communists that they had split from before. And they formed the United Palestinian Arab and Jewish Party, which became the Israeli Communist Party, essentially. You know, some prominent figures were involved in that. People like Emil Habibi, who is a great novelist. I recommend him. And there was a Palestinian minority left in the 48 areas that were taken over by the Jewish colonists, and which became the State of Israel. And those Palestinians were mainly represented through the Communist Party during that period. Then you have, you know, communists emerging in Gaza. There, that's the only Communist Party that carries the name Palestine Communist Party at that period. And again, the communists produced a lot of cultural and literary figures. So one of the great poets of Palestine, Moin Bseso, you know, he was one of the leaders of the Communist Party in Palestine. And incidentally, you can now find one of the best resources on Gaza now is the memoirs that have been recently translated of Moin Pseso's lifelong partner and comrade, Sahba al-Barbari. She's amazing. So those folks established the Palestinian Communist Party. Then you have Palestinian communists in the West Bank and Jordan, which, by the way, the bulk of Palestinians came under Jordanian rule in this period because Jordan took over the West Bank. Egypt, of course, took over administrative control over Gaza, but did not annex it. And Gaza absorbed the Palestinians from the areas south of Jaffa, west of Hebron, and the surrounding areas in the Gaza countryside, out of the Nakba as well. They received a lot of these refugees. Whereas West Bank received a lot of refugees from other parts of Palestine. And some of these also made their way to Jordan. So you had a huge amount of Palestinians now under Jordanian rule. And essentially, in those areas, the Palestinians became integrated into the political landscape of Jordan. So most of the people that were associated with the Palestine Communist Party, for example, became the founders of the Jordanian Communist Party in this period. When you say Jordanian Communist Party in the 50s, that's very much a mixed party that included people from the East Bank and the West Bank of the Jordan. But there was a preponderance of Palestinians in its ranks. Palestine had the strongest formations in that party and initially. Parties were emerging at this period rapidly, new parties. In addition to the communists which existed before and had to reconstitute themselves, you had the Ba'athists, of course, which included figures that were deeply influenced by what took place in at that time. People like Abdullah Rimawi, you know, who was horrified by the experiences of the Nakba. People like Bahjat Abu Gharbiyya, who had fought really hard during the Nakba to defend East Jerusalem. He was actually one of the youth that were involved in that. And he had previously, of course, he was a veteran of the 1936 revolt. Those figures, they ended up creating the Ba'ath Party. And again, at this stage, it was under Jordanian rule, and it was a unified party. The Jordanian arena absorbed basically the Palestinian political energies in the West Bank and Jordan. You had Palestinians join other Ba'athist branches in the countries to which they had sought refuge. Syria, for example, was a very important arena for Palestinian political life. It produced multiple formations. And you had a nascent body of movements that were new on the scene, did not declare themselves as parties yet, like what became the movement of Arab nationalists, that were also relying on young Palestinians. This is not to mention on the Islamic side, Palestinians launched something called Hizb al-Tahrir, which now has very few Palestinians in it. It's mostly, actually, I think, people from South Asia and people in the different diasporic contexts. But Hizb al-Tahrir was established by a Palestinian preacher, Taqi al-Din Nabahani.
And that's, their goal is to reestablish a caliphate.
Yes. Their theory was Palestine was lost and other Islamic lands were lost because of the fall of the Ottoman caliphate. But the first step for all Muslims should be to restore the caliphate, and then that will lead to the end of colonialism in all Arab and Muslim lands. So that's their basic theory. Initially, a lot of members, some Palestinians joined them not knowing that this was their theory, because Hizb al-Tahrir means the Party of Liberation. They thought that it was a party focused on the liberation of Palestine. And then later on, when they discovered that actually its main goal is to first establish the Khilafah, then liberate Palestine, they were like, What are you talking about? The sequence is a bit weird. And that was, of course, a critique that some Islamists were making also. Some people in the Islamic circles were really like, they're like, maybe you're a bit like unrealistic. Like you wanna...
It's not Qassam's Islamism.
No. But more importantly, you have the Muslim Brotherhood gaining strength in that period, particularly in Gaza and Jordan. In Jordan, the authorities are sympathetic to it. King Amir Abdullah, which later becomes King Abdullah the First, initially he actually authorizes the establishment of the Muslim Brotherhood, even though he was opposed to most political parties and so on. And he endorsed some of their initiatives, including the building of the Al-Kulliyya Al-Almiyya Al-Islamiyya, the Islamic Scientific College in Amman, 1949. Which becomes one of their main social institutions initially in that period. He sends King Hussein, his grandson, there for a year as a symbol of like endorsement. And that, of course, is a movement that's founded in Egypt. But there's a Jordanian figure from the East Bank, from Salt, Abdel Latif Abu Qura, who becomes a strong organizer for it in Jordan, and he manages to recruit a lot of Palestinians into it. So, to summarize all of this, is Palestinians are entering political movements big time during this period, but these are movements that are operating on a transnational scale. And they're addressing pan-Arab questions, and in some cases, pan-Islamic questions. And in the case of the communists, they're addressing international questions. So they're joining essentially an internationalist current, and a pan-Arabist current, and an Islamic current. What's missing here in all of this is the what had existed before, which was parties just dedicated to Palestinian local questions. That was under the mandate that used to be the party structure. All the parties were just addressing the Palestine question in as their main focus. They had other agendas, but they were not ideological parties that promoted bigger visions. The main feature of Palestinian political life in this period, which corresponds, of course, to developments in Arab political life, is that this is the era of the big parties and the ideological parties and the parties that have far greater ambitions than liberation of one corner of the region. They want to liberate the whole region, and some of them want to liberate the world.
Before we circle back to Nasser's Egypt, we should discuss where communists are in the immediate wake of the Nakba, because as we've referenced, I think, Arab communist parties were just tremendously undermined by the USSR support for the partition of Palestine. And the Ba'ath, Nasserites, and initially the movement of Arab nationalists all regarded communism at best suspiciously. There were also, and you did reference this, I think, a few minutes back, there was the critical arms shipment from Czechoslovakia to Israel during the war in Palestine. How did Arab communists respond to this enormous reputational challenge that was really not of their own making, but imposed from Moscow? And then what was the character and activity of the region's communist parties at this moment, a moment that in many parts of the world, it was defined by communist parties really entering the political mainstream of their respective countries. And we'll talk a lot more about the Iraqi Communist Party when we get to the July Revolution of 1958 in Iraq. But for now, what was the general impact of the USSR's role here? How did that impact the situation on the ground for communists all over the region?
Yeah, so this is a question I've been thinking about a lot recently because actually, there's a book that's going to appear in Arabic that I've been working on for a while, which is the memoirs of Dr. Munir Hamarne. It's based on interviews that I'd conducted with him and, that I'm working on producing in book format. It's unfortunately not going to be in English, but we're doing it in Arabic. He was the former Secretary General of the Jordanian Communist Party, and we talked a lot about the subject when we were preparing. He just passed away, unfortunately, at the age of 91, but he was a wonderful figure. And when you interview people like him, they tend to take a defensive position now in relation to the partition. And they say, you know, clearly the balance, international balance of power would not have allowed for anything other than that. Therefore, what should have happened is that the Arab governments accepted it and then established quickly and supported the establishment of a Palestinian state. Now, of course, there's a different version to the story that's given by, you know, the records of the period. The debates within the communist movement at the time indicate that most communists in the region did oppose the idea of partition. But the Soviet Union, of course, played a key role in enforcing partition, which, let me again explain what partition means. Partition means setting up a settler colonial state. It's a deceptive title because people think of it, they think of India, Pakistan. Well, everybody's indigenous to that region, India, Pakistan, okay? Greece and Turkey. People have been living in those areas for centuries. When they did like a population exchanges or whatever, it was horrific. But it's a different set of questions there. It's not about setting up a settler colonial state.
Though they all do indict colonial modernity in a certain way.
They all indict colonial modernity, but there's a big qualitative difference between the idea of setting up a settler colonial state and the idea of separating a joint space into two separate spaces based on either ethnicity or religion, which is essentially what took place under these so-called partition regimes in that period. So here, we're not really dealing with partition, not as far as Palestinians are concerned. It's the loss of Palestine. That's what we're dealing with, as far as they're concerned. Because they were asked to give, I mean, I'm telling you, the colonists, Daniel, for the most part, had arrived 10, 20 years before. And at best, they'd arrived a few decades before that. You know, the majority had arrived from the 30s onwards. These were not people that were seen as from this area, okay? It's not like this is a population that's from this area that's demanding a part of this area. No matter how much they'd like to claim that they are. So Moscow was coming in and was saying, look, we're going to support this project. They supported it at the UN. The countries associated with the Soviet Union put enormous amounts of energy at the UN to support it, Poland and Czechoslovakia in particular. If you go through the records, and I went through them, it's quite amazing. They were the biggest proponents, more than the United States. And some of them were driven by the anti-Semitism in those countries, like Poland in particular. And because the big question haunting Poland was what is going to be done with the Jewish refugees that had been expelled by Poland from Poland by the Nazis or put in extermination camps there. And initially, after the Holocaust, Daniel, there was this horrific reality going on in Poland where some of the right-wing elements and even elements associated with some of the more right-wing forces in the Catholic Church were still operating in Poland and carrying out anti-Semitic propaganda and carrying out some pogroms even. And the Polish government, you know, there's a big debate around this in the literature. Did the Polish government want that or not? Or did it do enough to stop it? And most of the literature will tell you they did try, and it wasn't like, of course, the Communist Party was, that was not their interest. They did not want anti-Semitism in Poland. But also the Communist Party itself had been infiltrated by members previously of the right that had now repurposed themselves to enter the government and that held anti-Semitic views. So you end up having a situation where there's these pogroms happening. The Polish government is unable to control the scene in its borders. And in the meantime, the Zionist movement is visiting them, encouraging them to adopt a program of supporting colonization in Palestine and sending all of these Polish Jews to Palestine. And rather than see this as a betrayal of Jewish life in Poland, the Polish government saw this as a nice solution for their own problems of being unable to integrate Jews in Poland and protect them as fellow citizens and sisters and brothers. This was a seriously, like, it's when you look at it, it's so morally shocking. But Palestinians end up paying the price because these Polish government goes into the UN and they're like, well, we have to solve the DP problem and this Zionism is great and we need to partition this territory.
Is it Poland's interest here in solving its post-Holocaust Jewish question that leads the Soviet Union Eastern Bloc towards supporting partition?
Well, the Soviets, that's one of their considerations, but they have other considerations. The Soviets, Stalin was a shrewd geopolitical operator, but in this case, he misread the map. He thought, for real, that, look, the Arab regimes at the time were controlled by Britain. And his view was, do I put my support behind regimes that are controlled by my Western enemies? And remember, this is the beginnings of the Cold War. This is right after World War II. The world is, it's clear that the world is going to be based on alignments. So he's thinking, how can I maximize the chances of producing favorable alignments for the Soviet Union? Would I want to back those regimes? Or would I want to support a potential ally that claims to have elements of socialism that includes many Russian speakers in its amongst its ranks?
And people like Ben-Gurion at this point is undecided about sort of where Israel will come down in the Cold War, or is he?
No. These people know they're going to go with the West, Daniel. But let me remind you something. Ben-Gurion comes from Poland. Okay, all of the Zionist political leaderships come, for the most part, almost all of them are from areas that are in the Soviet orbit. Culturally, they have immense relationships with governments there. They speak the same language. They understand the political system. And they have direct channels. Enormous amounts of affinities exist and relationships.
So even though Ben-Gurion plans the whole time on siding with the Western imperialist camp, they adroitly work their Soviet sphere contacts and relationships.
Absolutely. And they're signaling to the Soviet Union the idea that they will be friendly to it, that they will not fall within the Western Bloc entirely. You know, Stalin clearly thought that maybe he could win them over. I mean, the Czech arms deal would not have happened without his approval. And he thought, look, why not? Like, and it sounded potentially plausible. Because, you know, again, Zionism was using even socialist imagery and was doing all these appeals to socialist ideas. At the very least, I don't think that Stalin was stupid enough to believe that they'll put all their support behind him. But he thought, look, they're not going to be totally allied with the West. Remember, Daniel, at this stage, the colonists had revolted against Britain. Like this is the context to the immediate British withdrawal and the Nakba. The colonists, when the British, after the suppression of the 36 revolt, adopted the white paper that limited Jewish migration to Palestine, you started to have a direct clash between the colonists and Britain. Because the colonists now were strong enough, they were armed enough, organized enough to be able to challenge British power. And they knew that Britain would not be able to fully crack down on them. So, and they played a game, you know, using the Irgun and the Stern Gang to carry out that insurgency, even though the Haganah was participating with them, okay, in clandestine ways. So there was a clear tension between the colonists and Britain. Of course, we now know, and this was actually something that Ilan Pape had uncovered early on in his career that made it you know, it wasn't one of his main achievements, was to show that this is utter rubbish, the idea that Britain was opposed to the colonists at this stage or ever. You know, like he showed actually in 48, the British definitely worked to suppress a Palestinian state, but they were supporting a Jewish state. Stalin misread the map.
And so Stalin misread the map, and because of the basically highly centralized anti-democratic structure imposed on global communism, that misreading of the map that was deeply complicit in the Western colonial project and specifically in Zionist settler colonization of Palestine, something absolutely abhorrent to almost any Arab. What did that mean for the reputation, stature, and power of Arab communist parties in the wake of the Nakba?
Yeah, it was a serious problem, Daniel. I mean, I'll tell you something. There's a saying in Arab communist circles nowadays, when they reflect on the past, they tell you, when it used to rain in Moscow, people would open their umbrellas in Damascus, you know. So their connection to Moscow was unbelievable at the time. They believed that the Soviet Union was the savior of humanity. They believed that it could not do wrong, even if at their own expense. So you had this situation where within the communist movement, you had also local enforcers that really, really pursued that line. You know, figures like Khalid Bekdash, who was the head of the Syrian Communist Party, and the Syrian Communist Party had enormous power within the communist movement. He was really, for example, adamant that the Soviets can do no wrong, and he cracked down on all communists that critiqued the partition resolution. You have these humiliating letters of autocritique that they produced at the time, saying that they committed a great crime by questioning the Soviet leadership. You know, people were shamed. They were told that they're not real internationalists. They were told that they were engaging in nationalist deviation by having these ideas. And of course they were not. It's not, these people did not betray internationalism or become narrow-minded, xenophobic nationalists or anything like that by criticizing partition. What they were saying is that they felt that this was furthering a colonial policy and that it was a betrayal of anti-colonialism and that it was a betrayal of the Palestinian national question. So it was a very difficult reality at the time, Daniel, for communists. And they had to essentially move from a position where they were debating this question to one where they were justifying Soviet policy. And, you know, here we have to separate between two things. It's clear to me that before the partition resolution was adopted, there was no question that all Arabs would have opposed it. You know, no political current in the Arab world supported the idea of partition. And they shouldn't have, and they didn't. But then you get to the second phase of, okay, what do you do once the international order has actually adopted a position like that, and it is clear that it's putting all its weight behind the establishment of a Jewish state? Now, most of the Palestinian national movement and most Arab political currents thought that they could, that if they fight hard, they might be able to actually reverse that and prevent partition from being enforced on Palestine. Because remember, it's a UNGA vote that leads to it, a partition resolution. The facts on the ground could have reversed such a position. However, from the communist perspective, what they believed was that now there was a conspiracy on the part of the Arab states to not make use of some of the political openings that the partition resolution allowed for, which is the creation of a Palestinian state, at least, that could then fight for regaining the rest of the land.
But that's a bit of an ex post facto justification on communist part to justify Stalin's geopolitical maneuver.
Yes and no. So for I'm actually right now I'm working on a memoir by one of the communist figures of the period in Palestine, Al-Ashhab. He talks about the mobilizations that they carried out in Palestine because they felt that they're not able to defend the country adequately without a Palestinian government being set up. And to understand what was going on locally on the ground, you have to look at what the Arab armies were doing when they entered Palestine. The first step they took, especially with the Jordanian army, was to crack down on political life. And they were cracking down on the communists, they were cracking down on other parties, but especially they were cracking down on anybody associated with the old nationalist leadership, the Mufti. So by doing that, you're actually preventing any independent Palestinian political life, and political life becomes an appendage to the Arab regimes. The communists were saying, why not actually set up then a state in accordance with this international resolution that took place, and then it can develop the capacity to defend itself maybe, and you know, maybe the Arab armies, if they're serious, back that state up, allow it to emerge, keep Palestine on the map, you know. So that's the bit that I find in their argument to be convincing, but that's not how other political movements read it at the time. Basically, they were seen as legitimating the loss of Palestine or large chunks of it. You know, they essentially betrayed the Palestinian people as far as the that's what's their reputation. That was the attack that was launched against them. They were saying, look, you're saying that we should give the Zionist movement the best of the Palestinian coast. You're saying that we should give the Zionist movement, even though that coast is mostly inhabited by Palestinians, we should give them the most fertile areas in Marj ibn Amir, in the Jordan Valley. We should give them the main key parts of the country, even though they've been there for less than 30 years, and accept the depopulation of those areas, the ethnic cleansing, the destruction, everything that came with it. Renounce our right to those lands, maybe even. You know, people were going that far. Of course, that's not what the communists were demanding, but still, and there's truth to that. Any justification of the partition resolution as just or good, or which or and even in the case of the communists, that it was the pragmatic thing to do, would have been problematic. And they knew it.
And regardless of whatever sort of pragmatic argument one could plausibly make about supporting partition, setting that aside, there is no pragmatic case to be made for the Czech arms shipments.
Absolutely. Absolutely. This is where communists had a difficult time after 48. You know, Daniel, I really believe, like, had the Soviet Union taken in a slightly different role, you would have had and again, we're engaging in counterfactuals, but the popularity, I can almost guarantee you, having studied these movements for a very long time, the communists had a good basis for becoming the preeminent political movement. Because even after the reputational disaster that came as a result of this, and the demoralization and the ideological battles that came against them as a result, that were waged against them as a result, and the demoralization of cadres and the divisions within the movement, even after that, it still had a very strong role in the 50s.
Yeah, given how powerful the role in the 50s, especially in Iraq, but really in many places, given that, even with this kind of deserved, earned reputational harm, if that hadn't happened counterfactually, the political space available to Nasserism, secular nationalism, Baathism would have been much smaller and the communists would have been much stronger.
Absolutely. But also, by the way, many people that would have been Baathists and so on, the hostility of those parties as well, even the ones that wouldn't have joined the Communist Party, the hostility of those parties to communism,
right,
would have been also less strong. So, I mean, and people do reflect on this. A lot of the Arab radical political arena was weakened significantly by the split between the anti-colonial nationalists and the communists. Throughout the 50s, that split caused many bruises, and the 60s. And it led, by the way, to bloody phenomena. In Iraq, the reason why even the Baath itself becomes has a crisis of serious democracy and ends up being taken over by dictatorship is partly against the backdrop of this competition that had taken place. Who knows how the world would have looked like, the world of radical movements in the Arab world would have looked like had the partition not been supported. But I can guarantee you one thing. The hostilities would have been far less severe. Palestine becomes a central point that's always raised when it comes to this divide.
That was the fourth episode of Thawara, The Dig's new series on 20th century Arab politics with Abdelrazak Tikriti, who teaches history at Rice University. A scholar of Arab and Palestinian revolutionary movements, he's the author of Monsoon Revolution, Republicans, Sultans, and Empires in Oman, and the co-author of The Palestinian Revolution Digital Humanities Website, an incredible resource that will be back online soon. Thanks for listening to The Dig from Jacobin Magazine. As Marx once said, after noting that revolutions are the locomotives of history, while other podcasts have only interpreted the world in various ways, our point is to change it. We're posting new episodes every week. The Dig was produced by Alex Lewis. Our associate producer is Jackson Roach. Music by Jeffrey Brodsky. Our communications coordinator is Sylvia Atwood. Our senior advisors are Theario Francos and Ben Maybe. Check out our vast archives and newsletters at thedigradio.com. Follow us on Twitter and also now Instagram at thedigradio. And do find us wherever you get podcasts and subscribe to this podcast. If it is on iTunes or Spotify or wherever, also rate and review us. Those reviews help introduce us to new listeners. But what really does that is you telling people you know in real life to check out this pod. Please make propaganda for us. And do find us at patreon.com and make a monthly or annual contribution to keep this operation up and running strong. Even a few bucks is huge.